Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. I'm LaToya Johnson, your host for the New Books Network. And here with me is Dr. Kendra Hamilton, English professor and director of Southern Studies at Presbyterian College, to discuss her book, Romancing the Gullah in the Age of Porgy and Bess. Thank you, Dr. Hamilton, for being here. It's a pleasure to have you.
Thank you so much for having me, LaToya. It's really a great moment to be here.
Romancing the Gullah. It's a literary and cultural history on the Lowcountry region that encompasses the coasts of North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, and Florida, also known as the Gullah Geechee Coast. Can you talk about the process of writing the book, what inspired you, and the significance of Porgy and Bess?
Okay, so that's a lot.
And I can reiterate if you need. We have time.
What inspired me to write the book? Partly, it all began with a Christmas present. I was living in Virginia. I was in graduate school, going through my early classes, working with this really fabulous folklorist named Charles Perdue. And one of the things that he asked us to do was a final project that focused on a folklore project of our choice. And for the Christmas before I took that class, I received a gift from a good friend, a new friend, who gave me a first edition of Porgy. I am from Charleston. I had not known that Porgy, A, was a novel, right, before it was a musical. And I also hadn't known that the person that Porgy, the novel, was based on was a real person. But, you know, I got this book, took it home, showed it proudly to my father, and he was like, oh, Porgy was a real person, you know. Your grandmother knew him. And I said, what? And so that little moment, so I did, the project on the book. I interviewed my grandmother. I interviewed Mrs. Dowling, who was a childhood mentor and very much loved adults in my life. We lived in the suburbs of Charleston, but all at this time, this was during segregation. All the good schools were in the city. So Mrs. Dowling had a station wagon. And she would collect all the neighborhood kids and take them downtown to the schools, the good schools downtown. And so I spent all of my, all the school year in Mrs. Dowling's presence with her old daughters, at the Jenkins Orphanage, which I did not know I also did not know that the Jenkins Orphanage is this historically significant institution that produced generations of jazz musicians who then populated the bands of Duke Ellington, Lionel Hampton, Chick Webb, all the famous big bands of the dance era, of the jazz age and the dance era. No idea. So this project opened up a window into a world I hadn't known existed. And I have spent, I would say a good 20 years of my life trying to put the pieces together and trying to explain. And this book represents the culmination of that, my attempt to explain the significance of the time, the place, the people, especially the people, the Gullah Geechee people, who I discovered are my ancestors, right? So where should I go from there? Where do you want me to take it from there?
I just, was that the inspiration, though, coming from the culture? Was that the inspiration in writing the book?
Well, the first thing, so I wrote the, you know, so I wrote an essay that was published in Southern Cultures magazine about this experience, about learning about Porgy and Bess and learning my grandmother's story and putting this all together, right? But what I didn't understand was how much deeper it went. And another thing that I didn't understand, or that I felt like the scholarship actively prevented understanding what was going on with the culture. Most of the scholarship that was written about Gullah Geechee culture in the 20th century was written from by white scholars from a condescending racist perspective. There were folklore collectors in the 1920s, who had no idea what they were looking at and just made up a bunch of stuff that was flattering to the white ruling class. And then later in the century, the 70s, 80s, 90s, you start to see the emergence of African-American scholars and white scholars who take the language and the culture seriously. But what was striking to me was that I read all of this stuff. I was in graduate school, so I was reading a lot of stuff. I read all this stuff, and I didn't recognize myself in it. Either it was located so far in the past, or it was written from a perspective that was so alien that I didn't know, but these people were writing about me. First of all, I had never heard the word Gullah. I grew up in Charleston, surrounded by people speaking Gullah all day and all night. Well, number one, we thought we were speaking English. People told us that it was bad English, that it was broken English, right? But we thought we were speaking English. And Gullah was not a word that was used in my family. We used the word Geechee. I never heard anybody use the word Gullah. You know, I think that that was a word that was used on, you know, John's Island, James Island. But mostly, you know, on the streets of downtown Charleston, we knew each other as Geechees. And, you know, in the other places that we went, I remember going to Virginia, for example, and being teased by people saying, oh, you ain't nothing but a rice-eating Geechee. You know, and that was, and it was true. It was a rice-eating Geechee. So I think the thing that I was fascinated by and curious about was how the story got so distorted, A. And B, well, then what is the true story? What is Gullah Geechee culture? Well, I remember, for example, having an encounter with the writer, Verda Mae Smart Grosvenor, who's someone I very much admired. She wrote travel notes of Geechee Bureau, a number of cookbooks, was a regular on NPR, a very vibrant personality and spokeswoman for the culture. And in a book of scholarship called Black Hunger by a woman named Doris Witt. Otherwise, provocative exploration of Black women's writing and food, relationship to food. She has a chapter on Verda Mae Grosvenor, in which she basically accused her of not really being Gullah Geechee because she was from Allendale and not from AC Island.
I'm sorry, have you not looked at a map? Allendale might be 40 miles from the coast, okay? But, you know,
somehow people in the scholarship got this idea that the culture was this hermetically sealed bubble that only existed on these liminal, limited sea islands, and that was in the process of vanishing. And, you know, we were the vanishing Gullah, the vanishing, you know, just sort of like the idea of the noble savage. The noble savage is always vanishing, right? So Gullahs were, you know, celebrated, you know, all wonderful, this amazing culture, but it's vanishing, it's going away. And so what I discerned was that, yeah, there was actually two. So there's a sort of noble Goa, the sort of like maternal, paternal figure, source of wisdom, fount of all knowledge kind of thing on the one hand. And on the other hand, those bad-ass Geechies who were causing all the trouble, right? Who were, you know, protesting or doing crime or doing, you know, talking wrong or having too many children. So there is a sort of split, you know, good Gullahs, bad Geechies, right? And so how do you recognize this scholarly picture of celebration with the actual experience of Gullah Geechee people, which is of, you know, abjection and discrimination and exclusion and mockery, right? Mockery of the culture. And so there just needed to be a lot more digging into it. I wanted to point out the errors of the ways in which it was perceived, the ways in which a scholarship could make something that was just as familiar to you as your grandmother's face and turn it into something that was utterly unrecognizable. So I wanted to make the culture recognizable both to outsiders who don't have no idea what it is, and also to us who grew up with this distorted mirror and these distorted interpretations of our lives and what was meaningful in our lives. And so there's the plan of the book is that there is a sort of prologue section, a section one, that is just about orienting people, just about exploding the myths and just about explaining what Gullah Geechee culture is. And I came up with a model to help people understand it. Gullah Geechee culture is present when there's a confluence of language, the landscape, the language that people speak, the Geechee talk, that Geechee talk that is so scorned and denigrated, right, on the one hand, and yet studied and elevated by scholars on the other, right? Language and also the landscape, because this arises in a particular landscape, a landscape where rice is grown. And you have people from Africa who know the rice technology being brought over to create this cash crop. So you have a discrete group of people who know how to grow the rice. Because the way that rice is grown in the United States, one of the things that people, the Charlestonians like to say, is that Charlestonians are like the Chinese because they eat rice and they worship their ancestors. Well, no. Charlestonians are like West Africans because they eat rice and worship their ancestors. Because the technology that is used harnesses the power of the tides and the rivers to inundate the fields and, you know, facilitate the growing of the rice. But that got erased from the picture too. And the African genius, the fact that Africans were kidnapped for their advanced technology and brought Asia to, you know, create this technology in the United States. That had to be erased from the picture. And the final thing is lineage, because you have to be somebody who's from this lineage to be able to, you know, to be able to have this confluence of language and landscape and furica matter. So I explore in the introductory sections, which is, you know, partly autobiographical. I explore these contradictions and these lies and distortions about Gullah Geechee culture to provide a context for the exploration of texts. And the texts that I was really interested in were the texts by Black women writers of the 70s and 80s. You know, people like Paul Marshall and Toni Morrison and Gloria Naylor, culminating with, you know, June Dash, Daughters in the Dust. in the 1990s. That was what I really wanted to write about. But I realized that I couldn't write about what was happening in the 70s and 80s until I explained what had been happening before that. But there's this whole, you know, literary history of Gullah Geechee culture and language that had taken place 50, 60 years before any of the stuff that I was interested in even started. And so I wanted to create a canon of texts sort of explain the group of people who worked with this material in previous times, so that people who want to do writing about the writers of today, who want to write about the writers of the 70s and 80s, and also who want to write about people like, you know, Eden, what's your last name? I'll get the last name. Who want to write about the new generation of Gullah Geechee creative artists, poets, you know, performing artists, visual artists, fiber artists, but also especially the writers. That there's a context in which we can understand. Here's a group of materials and texts that you can compare this to. You can watch the way these metaphors and these conflicts, the way they have played out for a previous generation, because it's the same thing. It's at what Amira Garaka called the changing same. You know, it changes, but we are still exploring the same material. We're still, you know, mining that same vein of ore to bring the gold to the surface and present it to the public. So that's what the book attempts to do. It attempts to give an actual understanding, and part an understanding of Gullah Geechee culture that, you know, draws on the best of what has been written about that culture, as well as personal experience, as well as field research that I performed, because it wasn't just enough for me to interview my relatives, right? I also, you know, worked with the Phillips Sweetgrass community, for example, people who are from the Lowcountry being familiar with that. Over a period of 5 summers, we did field research with them, did work with them to help them, connect them with other Gullah Geechee communities so that people could, you know, fight off these development plans that were, you know, basically targeting the few remaining areas that Black people still have control of. They're still after our land, right? So all this stuff is connected. So I wanted to create a book that would allow you to see what was going on today in terms of runaway coastal development in the context of what happened at the end of slavery, and also what the writers were doing. So I want people to be able to make sense of the world that they see around them. And I think that this book goes a long way to connecting some dots that were not connected in the research previously, partly because the focus on the Black Southern experience has been, you know, not so prominent in the research. People have been very interested in the migration experience, very interested in the urban experience, very interested in the youth experience, the hip-hop generation, all of that. But in terms of, you know, the Black Southern people, the people who stayed, our experiences, the story we told, there has been less emphasis in the research on that. And so connecting those dots for people who, you know, aren't even necessarily aware that there are dots to be connected.
And you mention in the book specific outsiders and how they see and depict the culture. And it made me think of those from the lineage and how they desire to be seen, specifically for a particular generation. And I'm going to bring up a name here, Justice Clarence Thomas, because he grew up on the Isles of Georgia. And can you discuss the correlation regarding how writers and artists of the time portrayed the culture and the shame around those who are part of the lineage, the shame around the Gullah tongue and the Gullah language?
Right. Mm-hmm. I think that because there's so much emphasis in the scholarly literature on preservation, conservation, and celebration, that what is often obscured is the degree to which all of these things are endangered by the way the culture, you know, frames Gullah Geechees as backwards, ignorant country, you know, all of these things, that our language is baby talk. You know, there are languages, you know, sort of some sort of distorted English because our lips were too big to actually, you know. So these are, so the folklorists of the 20s Ambrose Gonzalez is the one that I'm thinking of. And he's got this famous quote about how the colonial English issued from the flat noses and thick lips of the Gullah Geechee, and that's why it sounds that way. Because we have flat noses and thick lips. And because we're too ignorant to, you know, to have good grammar. And no, you know, Lorenzo Dow Turner, the pioneering linguist, who came along and said, no, what you're hearing is, well, there are all of these distinct West African languages that are, you know, present in Gullah Geechee vocabulary that I've collected entire songs in Mende. That he's actually able to name this stuff. But that was an argument. That's the 20s, is Ambrose Gonzalez, the 40s, is Lorenzo Dow Turner. As of the 60s, everybody is still, imagine the 1960s. The only thing anybody knows about Africa is Tarzan, you know, right? So the pop culture idea about Africa is what it is. So I thought that Clarence Thomas was the perfect person to bring forward to explain this idea of linguistic prejudice, because linguistic prejudice is one of the last remaining socially acceptable prejudices, right? You hear stories all the time about white people, you know, language shaming people in grocery stores. You need to, my favorite story that just came up is a story on social media, a woman saying, oh yeah, this guy came up to us and lectured me and my mother about, you know, that you're an English now, you're an American now, you need to speak English. She says, I was speaking Navajo. So what language? what language do you propose that I should be speaking? Clarence Thomas is the perfect example, though, of someone who was shamed, you know, of his language. I chose him. He's from Savannah, outside of Savannah. Pinpoint is the name of the neighborhood. And in the story that is told about him, his mother's house burned down when he was a young man. It's kind of a very similar story to Richard Wright, right? So that his mother's house burned down, and he, the family moved into downtown with the grandfather, who was an entrepreneur there. And very strict Catholic, very religious. But Clarence Thomas was made merciless fun of because of his Gullah Geechee speech. And he had a terrible nickname. They called him ABC, America's Blackest Child. And so when you think about Clarence Thomas and just the hatred that he has for Black people, it really comes from these early days and from this bullying that he was subjected to. Shame you didn't just get therapy, but here we are. But he has spoken of, not speaking on the court, in oral arguments, not being heard very frequently, and said that the reason he doesn't talk is because he doesn't, he's always been ashamed of his Gullah Geechee speech, his accent, you know, the traces that can still be heard. So this stuff goes very deep. And that's what I was trying to, the introductory chapter is called, Mother Tongues in the King's English. And it's about that that tension between the tongue that is the language of family, of home, and hearth, and the language that we all have to speak in order to, you know, find success, you know, outside of the family. And explores linguistic issues like code switching and things like what they call the three-generation shift, which is a known linguistic phenomenon where you have two languages in the sort of bumping up against each other. One is economically powerful, the other less so, and how over three generations, people will gradually switch from the weaker language to the more powerful one in order to find acceptance and to win success. And so that's how the phenomenon of language death can occur. But, you know, here it is. It's been three centuries at Gullah Geechee. While the vocabulary has changed, has shifted, because Gullah Geechee vocabulary is mostly to do with the natural world, right? The environment in which they were surrounded, the tools and the techniques for tending the rice, or for taking care of your family, or for clearing the land. Now that we don't live in the woods anymore, we're not living on the plantation, we're not living on the land, the vocabulary is mostly English. But the deep structures of, you know, the syntax, you know, the syntactical things that are characteristic of Gullah Geechee speech are still intact. We still hear people using them. They're hilarious TikToks on Charleston. They call them Chucktown. They call Charleston Chucktown. So there's this whole genre of TikToks, which are just people saying stuff in Gullah, you know, but being hilarious, right? About, you know, whatever. So, you know, the kids and their crazy TikToks. But the essence of that is that they're talking about Gullah Geechee speech. You know, a linguist would look at this and have a whole bunch of stuff to say. You know, the kids watch it and they're just like, oh, that's my homies. You know, oh, that's fun, right? So but the language and the culture are still alive, right? Well, so what explains that persistence? What explains the fact that elements of that worldview from, you know, 1670, when the first Africans arrived in Charleston, South Carolina, what is it that makes us so cohesive and this so strong? And part of the answer that I propose is that, you know, Gullah Geechees are one of three original Black populations. They're sort of like, I call them the originals. You know, there's that silly Vampire Diaries spinoff called The Originals. This is actually kind of interesting because in the originals, half of the vampires are Black. So, like, yeah, they got something there. They got something there, right? There's something happening there. But we are the originals because there are three regions. This is something that that's explored in much of the historical literature, the colonial era historical literature, about time and place and when people arrive in a place and whether or not there are additional infusions of African, you know, populations, language, cultural stuff. All of those make a difference. And so the three areas are Charleston and the Gullah Geechee Coast, because that whole region. It's estimated, so Charleston was the number one, the largest port of entry for Africans before, you know, before 1776, before there was a United States, right? It's estimated that something like 25% of the native Black population of the United States is descended from people who entered the United States through the Port of Charleston. So there is a deep, deep, deep infusion of Black African cultural, you know, sediment that everything else in American culture is built on top of in Charleston. So that's the number one region. There's also another region of concentration up around the Boston region, but it's very Creolized very early. That population is not never achieves the numbers to be able to have the number of African survivals that that we have in the South. And the third one is New Orleans and the Mississippi Delta region. So everybody recognizes those. Those are the three cradles of Black culture and identity in the United States. And they have distinctive histories and identities. So I can't remember where I started till.
Oh, we were just talking about the, but yeah,
the three original populations. Right.
Okay, right.
In my opinion, the most important, but I love New Orleans too. New Orleans is one of my favorite places to be. And I love, especially, one of the things that allowed New Orleans to keep their culture so vibrant is the constant infusion from the Caribbean, of course, you know, people from Haiti and Cuba and all that other stuff, you know, and even Mexico coming in and out of New Orleans. But also their drums were never taken away, right? So the drums were taken away in the Low Country after the Stonewall Rebellion. And so that was the colonizers had their finger on something, because they understood that drums were the ways that were one of the ways that the enslaved were using to communicate, because they didn't understand the notion of tonal languages, right? And so drums can imitate the tones of human voices, so people could actually, they were actually talking drums. They could talk to each other across long distances and actually communicate messages, right, in the language that was going to be received, right? So once they took those drums away, they thought they were really slick, but that they had broken the back of Black resistance, and also that they would be able to, you know, colonize the minds of the enslaved. But no, we still had our secret language. We still had all of these different ways to communicate with each other that were occulted, unable to be seen by the colonizers. And so the development of things like the ring shout, the shouting tradition of hand bone, you know, of hand clapping and foot stomping, those traditions were ways to try to make up for the loss of the drums. Right? But yeah, for some reason, somehow, even though, of course, we know that there were there were illegal slave trading runs that continued all the way up to, you know, the eve of the Civil War. For the most part, the culture of Gullah Geechee is set in stone or set in place by the middle of the 17th century, right? The middle of the 18th century, so around the 1750s, 60s. And we have a discrete culture that is in place. And so continued importations of Africans. And for a while, people are saying, who visit Charleston, are like saying, this visitor from Switzerland goes, this is more like a Negro country than a country of white men. I don't, somebody else said it was like, visiting Satan's Kitchen or something like that. I have to find the but, you know, because there are so many Black, victims around, people were weirded out. And many of the, because of the seasonal epidemics, particularly the malaria epidemics, to which whites had no resistance at all, it was almost immediately fatal. Africans who survived malaria would develop some, you know, form of resistance, right? But of course, it killed plenty of us too. There was this legend or belief that Africans were immune from malaria. That was not true. That was very much a self-flattering, you know, fiction. But because of that, Charlestonians were largely absentee landlords. So people lived on these plantations in outlying, you know, counties, parishes they were called at that time. And there might be 80-90% Black. You know, there might be a plantation with 400, you know, enslaved people and 5 whites. right? So these people were largely left to their own devices. They didn't work in a gang system the way they did in cotton, because of, you know, the work on a rice plantation just needs to be distributed differently. So they worked a task system, right? So it would say you had to do a quarter acre of X in a day. Quarter acre is plenty, right? Imagine being a 15-year-old kid with a quarter acre task, right? So, but that meant that people were left largely to their own devices and were able to adapt the work to rhythms that were familiar to them. And so the songs, the spirituals emerged from our part of the world, from Bellagichi lands. So all of this stuff, being able to sing those same songs all for centuries in church, you know, either at Brush Arbor or after, you know, emancipation, when we were able to get land and build your own church. All of those things allowed us to keep our culture intact. And so there is a sense in which there's something about that landscape, that language, those people, that is authentic, that is more authentically African than any place else. And so artists have always been driven to sample from that well. People who heard the music they'd never heard anything like it in the 19th century. Kept trying to, you know, write it down, kept trying to capture it. They couldn't capture it, right? In the 1920s, we begin to have the kind of technology where we can take recordings, right? And so suddenly people can hear the sounds that people in South Carolina and Georgia and Florida have been hearing all their lives. And that means, so if you look at the Harlem Renaissance artists, people like W.E.B. Du Bois, who's writing in the Songs of Black Folks about the sorrow songs. He's talking about Du Bois is in Atlanta, at Atlanta University, right? Teaching at Atlanta University and doing basically founding the field of sociology by going out and doing research on the populations, the Black populations of Georgia, particularly around the Altamaha River, which is one of the famous rice rivers. So that's where the Gullah Geechee people are. So the stuff that he's writing about the sorrow songs and hearing that music and how it thrills him and it goes straight to his heart and how he's able to connect that to something in Africa, he calls it one of Africa's gifts to the world, the most beautiful music that's ever, you know, that's ever been created in the Western Hemisphere. So that's Du Bois. And then we have Gene Toomer, who's from, you know, his people are from Louisiana. His father is from Georgia. And he goes down to Georgia to spend, you know, to be the principal. He doesn't have a job. He hasn't finished college, but he's got a family friend who said, okay, you can have this job. So he goes down to being the principal at a school in Sparta, Georgia, that's on, you know, industrial education, sort of a, you know, Booker T. Washington model school. And Cain, which is like one of the most important and inspirational works for generations of Black writers, you know, all the way up to the present, emerges from that encounter with Georgia. But the research about the writing about these two men, they might as well have been in Mars as in Georgia. Right? There's no attempt. People are writing about their literary achievement without writing about the thing that inspired those insights, right? So I'm trying to connect that up. The other piece, though, is that we have white artists of the so-called Charleston Renaissance, which is actually a fairly, you know, it's a marketing category that was invented to sell paintings. That's fine. Critics are always do that, right? They create these categories, and that allows you to, you know, that gives you your claim to fame. So anyway, the Charleston Renaissance, right? We've got Porgy, which is written by DuBose Hayward, who's raised by a Gullah doll. Da is the word that was used at that time for a mammy in South Carolina. We didn't say mammy. We said da or mama. So he was so Gullah is his first language. His mother, is a widow. Her husband dies in an explosion in a cotton factory, and so you know these are people who are raised to like on plantations, and they're just trying to figure out how to work and make a living. So his mother begins writing poetry in Gullah and begins to make a living as a dialect recitalist. So basically, she writes poems and she gives performances in Gullah as a white woman. And she gets paid $50 for these performances, which back then, that's real money.
Remember, a lot of money.
Bread is 25 cents.
It's a lot of money for a widow.
So she's a widow with two mouths to feed. So, so you got that. Then you have the artists of... who are challenged by H.L. Mencken's, Sahara of the Beaux-Arts. H.L. Mencken wrote this very famous and satirical essay about the South called Sahara of the Beaux-Arts, spelled B-O-Z-A-R-T-S. Because his point is that the South used to be, the home of a great literary tradition before the war. And after the war, it's like a desert. There is absolutely nothing. People are bozos. They're ignoramuses. He says there's not one first class painting painter, one first class symphony, one first class, writer in the entirety of the South. So people are challenged by this. Some people are laughing, and other people are challenged. And it actually prompts a literary renaissance all over the South, right? But the one in Charleston, we've got the literary renaissance in Charleston. You don't have people writing comedies of manners about, Well, yeah, you have people writing about Gullah Geechee people. You have people singing, white people dressing up in plantation costumes and singing Gullah Geechee spirituals. The painters are painting the magnificent buildings that were built by Gullah Geechee artisans. And the subjects, the human subjects with those paintings, are always Black people. Women, Black women selling flowers, Black women, doing head porterage. They're carrying burdens on their heads. And everyone talks about how gracefully, women were able to, Black women in Gullah Geechee lands during head porterage when I was little. Like the oldest ladies could like put these giant baskets on their heads and, walk out and do work and nobody... It's gone, right? But the when I was a little girl, the last of the street vendors who drive around the streets with their wagon singing fishy, shrimpy, fresh crab, sea crab, strawberries, whatever it was that they had to sell. That was a tree that was dying when I was a little girl, but there were still a few left. Those are the things that they were trying to capture about Charleston culture. And those were the stories that they were telling about Charleston culture. They weren't telling all stories about white people. That's what the book is about. It explores why. The ways in which artists on both sides of the color line, particularly in the period of from the Jazz Age, 1919 is where I roughly start. 1919 is Red Summer, and Red Summer is the summer of where Black soldiers are returning from World War One and being attacked, and riots are breaking out because white people are whipped into insanity and paroxysms of fear and terrorism by the sight of Black men armed and the fear of insurrection. Fear, leads to these atrocities all over the country. And that leads to this, efflorescence of protest literature, poems, songs. And also people, basically are congregating in the cities now. They've come to the cities to either work in the war industries or just to get away from the South, just to get away from, the terrorism in the South. that great migration, and bang, you've got the Harlem Renaissance. All of this literature, all of this art, all of this excitement around Black people, Black stories, and even stories that they have to tell. Contrasting that with the Charleston, where white people are stung by the portrait of the South as being devoid of culture, and they're trying to, we do too have culture, but both groups are seizing on Gullah Geechee as something authentic, something powerful, something that they want to incorporate into what they're expressing, and how basically they're fighting for the right to represent it. I mean, white people say, we know the Negro. Well, this is what they say politically to the North, stay out of it, let us, have Jim Crow, and, we'll be good citizens as long as you let us, oppress Black people, and just stay out of it because we know the Negro, we know what he's really like. They're, criminals, and, they need to be kept under control, and you need these laws. But they also, that is the celebrated thing. That's part of the underground, the mother. All these people had African mammies, African American. So that culture is part of their heritage too, denied, but this being able to use it in art, I think, is a way of controlling it, is a way of owning it, right? Continuing to own it, even though you can't own the people. Whereas for Black people, it's the Black people, the artists of the Harlem Renaissance. And I haven't even mentioned the most important one, who's Ornella Hurston. But for the Black people, the Black writers of the Renaissance, it is about claiming what's true and powerful in their heritage for them as a method of resilience and building for the future. Right? For whites, it allows them, to establish a connection to the glory of slavery. I mean, they thought it was glorious. They thought the South was great. Like, they weren't ashamed. It wasn't cool to own people, right? And the Civil War's, that was probably a mistake, right? But we're not ever going to admit that. But, right. Yeah, so the whites, the Black writers, the white writers, artists, the music. And for me, it all comes together in the battle over making Porgy and Bess, making Porgy the novel into an opera. And,
In chapter 6, Dr. Hamilton, you discuss author and anthropologist Zora Neale Hurston in depth. It is wonderful to read, by the way. And just sent my soul a flutter, ma'am. Where you write, we know things Hurston intuited and may make claims that would have been vigorously contested in the mid-1940s. But as an African-American woman, she faced resistance, envy, and relentless negative appraisals of her person and her work. And this is still indicative in the contributions of Black women now, scholarly and otherwise. And can you please talk a bit about her connection and contribution to the Gullah Geechee culture?
Right. So one of the things that I'm very grateful to for is the work of the National Park Service in basically, outlining the extent of the Gullah Geechee Coast, how it basically goes from Cape Fear, North Carolina, down to middle Florida, right? The last of the Rice Rivers is the St. John's River in Jacksonville. But the culture, of course, penetrates deeper than that. And so one of the things that Zora Neale Hurston does as a Florida writer is that she was fascinated with the various cultures of African peoples in Florida. Not the Florida panhandle culture, the turpentine, you know, sort of camp culture, the Bahamians who, you know, came in from the South to work the orange groves, and also the Gullah Geechee people from Georgia, you know, that sort of collision and that gumbo of people. And so one of the things that she does as the first trained African-American anthropologist and writer in the, you know, in the nation's history, is to begin collecting folklore from all of these populations and beginning to try to understand, codify what the characteristics, and this is the title of one of her essays, what the characteristics of Negro expression are. What are the common things? What are the common themes? What is connected to Africa? What is, you know, what is the debt to the American Indian? What part is European? She's teasing all these threads apart. So the work that she does is both welcomed and resisted, right? She makes connections that no one has made before. She makes the connections, for example, between the Seminole Indians, the story of the Seminole Indians, and the fact that they had Black allies, Gullah Geechee allies. And in the fighting of these three critically important wars in the long 19th century, the first one is like, you know, in the 1780s. And the last war is like it concludes in 1855. I mean, it's like right on the eve of the Civil War. And so this huge alliance between Gullah Geechees and Seminole Indians, they defeat the U.S. Army. They negotiate a settlement where they get to keep their arms and go west to Indian territory, which at that time was Oklahoma. And so here's a story that's never been told before, right? And that nobody actually wants to hear then. Because people, there are no Negroes, right? People are about progress. They're about modernity. And here is Zora Neale Hurston, and she's talking about the fact that that the Black church is actually strongly influenced by pagan African rituals. What? We can't talk about that. You know, we are good Episcopalians now. We are not doing any spirit procession and dancing around in ring shouts. Stop that. So Zora is really runs into the talented tent, right? The audience, the Black audience for her work is the people who are educated, university educated, and who, you know, are professionals. And they are highly vulnerable to stereotype threat, right? The threat of being associated with those country backwards, Geechee people, those ignorant Gullah Geechees. Nobody wants that association with the country. Black people still have an issue with being country, right? I remember going to college and folks, the worst thing you could say about somebody was that they were Obama. So we still do that, right? So Zora, in writing about, she found, for example, one of her great essays is the one that just came out recently, as the book Barracoon, which is where she found the last survivor of the last illegal slave run in Alabama, Cosula, and interviewed him and told his story and couldn't get it published. Nobody at that time was interested in the story. And her the novels in which she tells the stories of rural people, rural women, rural wives, rural conflicts, are panned by the Black intelligentsia because they are, Richard Wright wrote just unbelievably, you know, acerbic review of Their Eyes Were Watching God, in which he basically said it was a minstrel show, that it's you know, it, just like the menstrual cycle, it followed the safe orbit between laughter and tears. And but the, also they were, she wrote about sex. She wrote about, you know, desire. She wrote about women's lives and in ways that was not sort of like, it was the acceptable, socially acceptable or the desirable narrative, the one that was sort of like critically acclaimed in the 20s was the passing narrative, you know? Although the trials and tribulations of the poor, you know, light-skinned person, you know, the blacker the berry, plum bum, you know, books like that. The protagonists were always middle class, you know, and or aspiring, and the fact that she wrote about rural people who were actually happy with their lives, but she took their lives seriously, that she took their struggle seriously, it made her very much on the outs. And you know, just you have to add the fact that she had a real people didn't like her, right? Zora had she's really funny, really smart, right? And but she was really cool, you know, there were certain things that really set her teeth on edge. Like there's an essay in which she calls talks about, I think this is how it feels to be colored me, but I'll come back. I'll get the title right in a minute. There's one in which she talks about how annoying it is to be asked by you know, these trim and proper, you know, all northern Negroes about the better thinking Negroes. What do the better thinking Negroes in the South want? Like that kind of question really bored her. She says, I don't know anything about the better thinking Negroes. I know who the think they better Negroes are. So she, you know, could give as well as she got. And she was notorious for feuds, right? She hated Du Bois. She called him Dr. Dubious, right? She had a number of like really hilarious nicknames for him. and she fought with people over their interpretations of the evidence. She took great exception to Du Bois calling the spiritual sorrow songs, for example, because she said that they expressed every imaginable state of consciousness and every state of being. Sometimes it was just a gossip. Sometimes it was, you know, sometimes it was actually joy. So the idea that they could all be, you know, that this is the condensation of the Negro sorrow, she says that's an oversimplification and an insulting one, right? And she always advocated for giving rural people voice and tried to capture their voices. And so there's all these people who are trying to make money off of the rural people, right? So they're going to push back against that. And like I said, Zora was really, she got into a fight with Alan Locke, for example, who was the guy who wrote the book, The New Negro, and sort of like the intellectual father of all of Renaissance. She went after him so hard in an essay that they wouldn't even publish it. So at the end of her life, she was falsely accused of sexually molesting a 10-year-old boy. It was proven later that she was not even in the country when this was alleged to have happened. But the entire Black intelligentsia turned on her. And it was fascinating. Someone that she had feuded with earlier, Langston Hughes, was the only person who was willing to come to her defense, even though they hadn't spoken to each other in almost 20 years. He was willing to come and testify on her behalf because he knew she didn't do that. But yeah, Zora, she was hard for people of that era to understand and to take. And the work that she was doing wasn't valued by the Black community at the time. In the decades since, both her method, which was strongly criticized at the time, and her insights have been all proven to be true. For example, she she set out when she was traveling through Haiti to investigate the phenomenon of the zombie. And you remember, we started out this conversation talking about zombies. She discovered that there's actually that it was the Bokor, which is the evil, you know, spiritual leader who makes the zombie. There's an actual formula of plants that induce an apparent, you know, death. You know, the person looks like they died, but then that person can be revived, and the drug serves to keep them under control, so that the dead person, the allegedly dead person, comes back to life and can be found working. That is the true horror of the zombie, is that it is an enslavement that goes on after death. That's why Black people don't mess with
zombies. We don't mess with it. No, ma'am, we don't.
But because the horror for us is the horror of not being able to rest even in death, right? So, but of course, Hollywood did something very different with that. Hollywood just turned that into, you know, fear of Black people, fear of being consumed, invaded and controlled by an alien consciousness. Somehow they, you know. So it's not about work for them. And in African-American, Afro-Caribbean culture, it is about labor. It is the horror of being forced to labor for eternity, you know. But anyway, so she discovered that the zombie state could be induced through drugs. And that was completely ignored until the 1980s, you know, Harvard anthropology student read Tell My Horse, which is her book about Haiti, and set out to find out, well, what's the formula? And he actually was able to find the formula. So people proved the stuff. He found somebody who could do it. He found out what the formula was, and it's published, right? Can't remember the name of the book. I'll look it up for you, though, and we can, you know, add that as a link if people are exploring that. But so her explorations of the connection between the Blacks and the Seminoles, her work on the sanctified church, so many areas in which in her work was pioneering, and, you know, if she wasn't completely right, she pointed the direction so that people could answer these questions. But it was, nobody Black at that time was interested in hearing it, right? She is writing about Kosala, the last African, the last African slave, last living African slave, not the last slave. There's plenty of slaves still alive when Zora's Ringers, the last slave from Africa. At the same time, the Scottsboro Boys is going on, you know, which is the cause celeb of the day, where a group of young Black men are accused of raping white girls on a train. And so Langston Hughes, Richard Wright, you know, W.B. Du Bois, all the big names are wrapped up in the Scottsboro Boys case and, you know, proving their innocence. That is the cause of the day. Zora Neale Hurston's talked about all this old stuff that nobody wants to look at. Nobody wanted to hear about Kosala's pain on being separated from his family and the ways in which he tried to keep his culture alive and people laughed at him. And he eventually had to establish a settlement called Africatown so that the people from Africa could be safe from the scorn and the prying eyes of both whites and, you know, unsympathetic Blacks. So she dies penniless, right? And it takes Alice Walker to rediscover and recover her. And, you know, and that scene in The Color Purple where Seeley and Suge Avery are trying to figure out where Seeley's real father is buried, and they're on a, you know, the cemeteries on the road, and they have no idea. So they basically just throw, an object where it lands. That's where they build the grave. That's kind of like what Alice Walker did, in the graveyard where Zora is. That nobody really knows where her grave was. So she just picked a spot and put up a monument to her, and that's where she's remembered now. So I think that African Americans of the 60s were ready for what Zora had to impart, because we were involved in that search for roots, right? We were looking for, so what she wrote inspired scholars, writers, artists, and gave us a blueprint. But at the time, she was very much a prophet without honor among her own people. And so, she was very important. I'm glad you enjoyed that chapter, because it's the last chapter that I wrote. And it was one that I, it's funny because the last chapter in the book is the first chapter I wrote.
Oh, okay.
But the Zora Neale Hurston chapter is the last, yeah.
Well, Dr. Hamilton, when can we expect Romancing the Gullah in the Age of Porgy and Bess to be available to all of us?
June 1.
Yes.
Readers now on Amazon or at University of Georgia Press.
Oh, great. Yes. And I recommend everyone picking it up. It is just this great read of the history, the cultural history and the literary history of Charleston and of Gullah Geechee culture. Thank you so much, Dr. Hamilton, for writing it and letting me be the first to read it.
Oh, I'm so thrilled that you read it and you had fun, right?
So much fun. So much fun.
It's going to be a fun read. The academic books are, kind of dull. And there's stuff in there that just has to be in there, because it is a book for scholars. But I wanted it to be a book that was accessible to everyone. And I find the story really interesting and sometimes hilarious and funny. And I certainly hope that other people enjoy the stories that I tell as much as I enjoyed writing it.
Yes, yes. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Hamilton.
Thank you, LaToya. I really appreciate it.